Good morning. Good morning. Does my mic work? I guess it does. Okay. So, I guess as you've seen from emails, I've tried to put together a schedule I think should generally work for finishing up the assignments we have in motion. I understand that might not actually work for everyone. If you have some sort of concern about that, you should talk. I just want to give a general extension because we have to figure out how to do this in a good way, given that we're so close to the end of the semester. So that might require special cases depending on what your circumstances are and what else you have going on at the end of the semester. And you might need to consider, in some cases, options like going beyond the normal end of the semester and things like that. So if you're having issues with finishing up coursework, let me know. We can figure something out. Also, if you look at the schedule, you'll see that there's, in addition to the assignments that sort of would normally been due next week, there's a final assignment, which is labeled as memory. I think it should be okay to keep that. Generally, I believe students in prior semesters have found this to be one of the shorter assignments, so it shouldn't be too bad, and it might need to be changed based on what lecture material we get to anyway, so it might become shorter. So I think that shouldn't be a problem, likely will stay, though it might change just because of what lecture material we get to by the time that it's sort of you're supposed to be doing it. So that's on sort of logistical things. I'll try to get back to finishing up our topics with the question first. Yes?
Can you turn your mic up?
Can I turn my mic up? It is way up already. Is that better? No? Yes? Ish? Let's see if these mics are different, since this mic definitely does something, but apparently is really insensitive. The alternate mic is better. So, okay, this mic is definitely louder than the other one. That's weird. Okay. So, other questions, comments about things not being visible or something? Okay. So, last week we were talking about optimizations, focusing a lot on what compilers could and could not do. Now, I mentioned that from a practical point of view, sort of just making sure a compiler is doing as much as it can is probably one of the best and easiest things you can do to like make code faster. But compilers sort of don't do everything. I mentioned they have some big limitations. So one of them is that compilers are kind of fighting this war where people complain about compilers being slow. They don't want to be slow. So they sort of have to do things in a way which maybe takes some shortcuts to be reasonably fast. And one of those shortcuts is that for the most part, there are exceptions. For the most part, compilers tend to act a function at a time. And this means that they won't do some optimizations between functions that might be fairly easy for you to do, just because, you know, if we had the compiler kind of analyze function A calls function B calls function C, and like look for special cases based on the values being passed from function A to B, you know, every time, that would just be too much work. Compilers also kind of have to guess at how the code they're compiling is going to be used. And one way this manifests is that for optimizations like loop unrolling, they need to kind of guess what the size versus speed trade-off is. Like a lot of these optimizations make the code much bigger. The compiler doesn't really know whether that's worthwhile or not, and generally has the default to doing something that people won't complain too much about, which is usually like not doing things like loop unrolling, which, you know, if you do it all the time, you're going to have huge executables and people will complain. Another issue we mentioned compilers had was with just generating code that does what the code says, and that seems like that shouldn't be a problem, but a lot of optimizations we want to do kind of change the code in corner cases that we as humans know aren't something that's supposed to matter, but the compiler doesn't have that luxury to second guess our code and say, well, you didn't really mean it to do this. And a big case where this comes up was aliasing. And aliasing is a name for just having two names for a single value. So typically this is two pointers that point to the same variable or array, could be other forms. And the big thing is that this prevents optimizations that might reorder calculations or avoid storing things. So like if we store a value somewhere and then read a value from somewhere else, well, if there's aliasing, we can't delay that store, which the compiler might want to do if we want to keep the value we're storing in a register instead. So in this way, aliasing can be a big problem for a lot of optimizations that are intuitive to us, where the compiler is worried about this silly corner case that we really don't care about. Hopefully that water will find through. Okay. And also we talked about another specific optimization. Two other specific optimizations. One was inlining. So inlining is an optimization that's sort of kind of akin to loop unrolling, but function calls. So with loop unrolling, we lowered the overhead of all the loop bookkeeping. With inlining, we're lowering the overhead of function call bookkeeping, where we have to put the arguments in a specific place, put the return value in a specific place, save the return address somewhere, read the return address. We're hopefully eliminating that bookkeeping. And also, we might allow other optimizations. So for example, if I'm calling a function, if I have a function A, which has an if statement, if I inline a call to A, I can hard code the result of that if statement. So inlining will often allow other optimizations that wouldn't normally be possible. And so inlining is something we mentioned compilers do, that they don't do it all the time because it's something like loop unrolling, it would expand your code drastically. And also, they'd have issues with inlining a function where they don't know what the function's code is yet. Can't really do that. And finally, we mentioned a common pattern of optimization where we have a loop, where we have some operation we're doing over and over again that we could have avoided by sort of realizing that we don't need to recompute it every time loop runs. We started with the example of having a loop where we accidentally computed a string length every time, and we mentioned that in that case it happened that the sort of mostly function at a time way compilers work would typically make a compiler have a hard time optimizing that for us. We also looked at this pattern where we had sort of redundant comparisons that we could have simplified. This is something that, if you looked at the smooth assignment, kind of comes up there too. And that's, I believe, roughly where we left off last week. So questions about these things we covered last time, or logistics? Okay. So, today's topic, we're going to look at what the lab that you may or may not have done yesterday is about, which is vector instructions, or SIMDI, single instruction, multiple data instructions. And sort of as a, you had a preview of this in loop lab. So loop lab, when I did loop lab, the original assembly was about 2 cycles per element in my machine. When I enrolled it, it was 1 cycle per element. When I unrolled it and used multiple accumulators, it was half a cycle per element, meaning that we did sort of 2 address computations and 2 adds into the sum every iteration, every cycle. So 4 adds per cycle. But when I used the version that was optimized by client NGCC that we provided, I got performance around 0.13 or 0.14 cycles per element. So much, much faster. And I'd say, well, what were these special versions doing? How could they be so much faster? And well, they were taking advantage of some instructions that we didn't really have. And there are instructions that, which is a single instruction that adds 16 pairs of shorts all together. This is called a vector instruction, so-called vector, because we act on sort of a little array of values, called a vector, or SIMD for single instruction, multiple data. There's one instruction that works on multiple independent pieces of data. So we're going to look at how those instructions work and how we can use them. So we're going to look at this with the add example you might remember from the lab. So here is just for ints, lab dealt with shorts, we're dealing with ints here. And I have a loop that we add a bunch of pairs of ints together and store the result in our original, one of our inputs, A. So this is A plus equals B, element by element, for every element of A and B, which are 512 entry arrays. And we want to use one of these sort of SIMD, these vector instructions. So my first step for doing that is I'm going to expand the loop. And in this case, I've expanded the loop, and now I have, this loop has 8 adds. And my goal is going to be to use this instruction to do those 8 adds. And the way our SIMD instructions mostly work is that they mostly add pairs of values between their arguments. So we're going to do all these adds with one instruction. Note that they're all independent of each other. You know, so we aren't like computing the sum of everything. We're just computing the results of, you know, these pair, sum of the first thing from A and the first thing from B, the second thing from A and the second thing from B, and so on. We're computing the sums of these pairs of values. So the add instruction is doing 8 adds, it's doing 8 independent adds. So the assembly we're going to want to get is going to look like this. And we have a bunch of new instructions here that are going to go through. So first, we have this REX here. So REX is going to be our loop index, but it's going to be kept as the number of bytes into A or B. So rather than keeping I, which is the, you know, number of elements, we're keeping the number of bytes, and that's going to simplify our loads and stores later on. This is commonly a transformation the compiler will do for you, which does make this assembly simpler. So our first instruction here, this move, is a move. And this move moves from A plus REX, so the number of bytes going into A, so the current location in A, into YMM0. And these YMM registers, there's 16 of them, are 256-bit registers. So 256 bits. So we're loading 256 bits of stuff into them with this instruction. So we load 256 bits of A into YMM0, 256 of B into YMM1, and then we have this special vector add instruction that takes A and B, adds them together, and stores the result in our vector register YMM0 for A. So unlike the add instructions we're used to in normal x86, when they added these instructions, they said, gosh, it would sure be useful to be able to write the result of the add somewhere other than one of the sources. So they made it a pre-argument version. Once we get that result, we store the result back into A. Then we advance by 32 bytes, that's 256 bits, and increase our, and check whether we're done with it. So sort of, we have a picture version of this. where we, you know, in each iteration loop, we're loading 8 elements from B and 8 elements from A using these move instructions into YMIM1 and YMIM0, which hold 8 elements. We're doing this add instruction, and that's producing the sum of each pair of values. Questions about what this assembly does. And we have a step I didn't draw here where we take the result of this and move it back into A. Yes? Question is, how does this movement, the first move instruction, mean to move 256 bits? So that this moves 256 bits is because of the size of the move, which is represented with this DQU. Or alternately, because the size of the move kind of implied by us moving into YMIM0 and not into like RAX. Does that answer your question?
Yes, yeah, so the trigger is not within A and RAX itself, but rather
question, yeah. Question is, the size is not specified by AREX, it's specified elsewhere, yeah. Other questions? Okay. So you might say, okay, so we have this instruction that adds a bunch of pairs of values. You might say, wait a moment, we were learning about out-of-order processors, and we learned that they can have like a whole bunch of ALUs available and dispatch to them. Like, why is this going to be faster than just writing a bunch of apps? So we're going to talk about like what's the typical implementation of this. And typically, when we have vector instructions, we're going to have some ALU which basically has a whole bunch of lanes. And lanes will correspond to like the elements of the input vector. So those one for each pair of values. So we'll build this fancy ALU which takes in 256 bits of input and does the appropriate number of adds. So in the case of our 32-bit adds, does eight separate adds. It kind of has basically extra copies of the adding logic sort of built in, so kind of like it's a bunch of ALUs stapled together. And they'll all take their inputs all at once and give all the outputs for every pair of values we're adding together all at once. So that's sort of what the typical hardware is going to look like. And you might say, well, gosh, if we're adding all these extra ALUs, why do we only let you access them with these instructions where you have to specify all the values to pass to all the ALUs together? Why don't we just use our out-of-order idea and just let you have separate add instructions that use all these ALUs? Like, that's a lot more flexible, that would allow us to make the original version of the code fast. So why are we adding these vector instructions? And from a hardware designer's point of view, one way of thinking about it is that when we add more ALUs to dispatch to, we have a whole bunch of extra logic we need to add alongside that. So we need to, say, fetch more instructions in order to fill all those ALUs. So we need to make our instruction fetch logic handle more instructions at once, which means our branch prediction needs to go more instructions ahead. We need to make our instruction queue bigger. We need to make the logic that goes through the instruction queues and figures out what instructions are ready now. We need to make that logic bigger. We need to make our logic for handling, like, undoing instructions on a branch misprediction or like a seg fault. That needs to be bigger to handle having more instructions in flight and support adding these extra normal ALUs. So if we're adding just normal ALUs, that would mean we'd add a lot of extra control logic. And it turns out that typically the size of that control logic is larger than the size of the ALUs themselves. But vector instructions let us use essentially the same control logic we had before. It's all the same stuff we were doing when we just added two single values together. The control logs look basically exactly the same, but now we give applications access to a lot more computational capacity with the same control logic. So this is a way of getting away from this problem where we add more and more control logic and, you know, to get access to more computation, now we can add a little control logic and a lot more ALUs and actually use those extra ALUs and make better use of the space on our chip. So for this reason, most of the major general purpose processor manufacturers have implemented some sort of vector instructions. Also, there's some processors that have been around for a long time for more special purpose things like GPUs, which have been based on vector instructions for a very long time. So we know what vector instructions are, we know what the code that uses it looks like, and we might say, well, you told me with your first example that the compiler did this. You just optimized the original code with the compiler and used vector instructions. So why would we need to care about that? And the compilers are pretty good at using vector instructions sometimes, but there's a lot of things which can mess them up. So aliasing is like a big problem for using vector instructions because we need to like store a bunch of things at once. We're changing the order of storing and loading. Conditionals are a problem. So you saw that I can add all the values. If I wanted to like add only some of the values, that's a lot more tricky. Some operations don't have vector instructions. So if I want to like do an operation without vector instructions, if that's in there, the compiler probably just gives up on vectorizing it and using the vector instructions for it, rather than trying to think of a way around it. And generally, I found it's very non-intuitive when a compiler will or won't use vector instructions if you turn on its optimizations. Maybe this will get better as compilers get better and as processors support sort of easier to use vector instructions, but the recent state is not great. So as an example, here I have two pieces of code, both of which can be written in a way which makes good use of vector instructions. And with GCC and Clang a couple years ago, the first was vectorized and the second wasn't, and the difference is just the order of the loops. Both are definitely vectorizable without changing the loop order, but it's just that one of them matched some patterns they had for how to vectorize things and one didn't. And I had no way of guessing this. I don't know that there's a, I think you need a lot to know a lot about the compiler's internals to like guess when that would happen or when that wouldn't. So, if the compiler's not gonna work, what are the alternatives? And in this class and in our upcoming assignments, exploring one of these alternatives, which are what we'll call intrinsic functions, and these are, C functions are compiler override that the compiler will compile to specific instructions. So I'm going to look at what that looks like for add. And these look really ugly. So these are the intrinsic functions that Intel came up with. So Intel made up these functions or these type names, and Intel is horrible at naming things. So to start out, we have this new type, underscore underscore mm256i. And this is a type for 256 bits of integers, so this is going to be something that's stored in one of those YMM registers. There's also different types for floats and doubles, but for some reason, Intel decided that all types of integers use the same type, even though we're going to have different instructions depending on whether we're working with like ints or shorts or longs. But they decided they all use the same type in C. Just arbitrary. So then we have some intrinsic functions that represent our move instructions. And you'll see that there's this general naming convention of these functions. So they start with MM256. So the 256, you can guess, is because they're dealing with the 256-bit registers. The MM is probably because the first version of Intel's vector instructions were called the multimedia extensions. And they seem to have never walked away from that name. And they end with sort of something that indicates the size of values the instruction acts on. For these load and store instructions, it's a 256-bit integer value, which they use SI256 to represent. I'm not expecting you to memorize, you can look this up, but let's try to make sense. And we have this load U and store U. The U stands for unaligned. So the normal version of load and store require the address you pass to it to be a multiple of 32. If it's not, your program will say fault. The unaligned version doesn't require that. The reason why you want it to be a multiple of 32 is that means it doesn't have to cross two different cache blocks. We're generally not going to be concerned about that. Obviously, it would be better if we ensure it doesn't, but it doesn't affect performance very much on most processors. So here we have our move to load into A values and B values, and these, again, these variables represent specific registers that are going to be those YMM registers. We have a store, which stores one of these YMM registers back into A. And because we're passing a pointer to this 256 type, we're loading 256 bits of stuff, not just A of I. We're loading A of I plus 1, A of I plus 2, and so on. And the same with B. We also have to do an add, and here we have our add intrinsic that represents the specific add instruction, and it's postfixed with EPI 32 to represent we're adding a bunch of 32-bit values. It's a bunch of pairs of 32-bit values. Some questions about this add code using intrinsics. So this is a way of explicitly telling the compiler generate that loop I showed you earlier. And we can also do this with different sizes. So here I'm doing it with ints. I could also do the same thing with longs. What would I change for that? Well, instead of going by 8, I go by 4, because that's how many longs fit in 256 bits, and that's how much we're loading. That's how big the registers we have to deal with are. And I change the add from loading pairs of 32-bit values to loading pairs of 64 values. So it turns out sort of the vector ALUs here are like reconfigurable. They work on different sizes of elements. So going back to our int version, we can sort of draw what's happening as something like this now, annotating with the instruction and the sort of equivalent names we have in C. So these intrinsics are basically a way of avoiding writing the actual assembly, but still telling the compiler to use these instructions we know are going to be better than sort of the naive single add instructions and single load and store instructions. Questions about this example. Okay, so let's do this exercise here. So here I have a bunch, two arrays of longs, and I do some stuff to load them into vector registers, so these YMM registers that are going to represent these variables, and then I store something back into bar. And my question is, what's bar's value? And note that these are arrays of longs, and our vectors are 256 bits, which is 4 longs. So if I load starting at foo of 0, like I do here, I'm going to load the first 4 values of foo. And there's one function we haven't seen in here, which is this wall low. So this is a multiply and give the least significant 64 bits, which is a normal multiply if no overflow. But the low in there is just because there's another version which gives you the the multiplication with the lower 64 bits per minute to give you the higher bits of the result if you wanted it. Would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G? Okay, so we have consensus that didn't write any of the answers. So let's go through what happened. So our foo zero as vector, we're loading starting at foo zero. And we're loading 256 bits. So in this case, with longs, that's going to be four array elements. So I end up with 1, 1, 2, 2 as my vector. And when I load from foo of four, I start at this 3 here, and I load 4 elements, so I end up with 3, 3, 4, 4 as my vector. And then I add those pairs of values together, so the result I get is 1 plus 3 is 4, 1 plus 3 is 4, 2 plus 4 is 6, 2 plus 4 is 6. The result I get is 4, 4, 6, 6. That's the initial value of that result variable. Then I take that 4, 4, 6, 6, and I add it to bar 0 as vector, which I loaded from bar starting at this 2 here, so that's going to be the first 3 elements. So my bar is going to be 2, 2, 3, that's bar 0 as vector, and my, I already determined my foo, my result is going to be 4, 4, 6, 6, and we're multiplying the pairs together, so just like the add, we multiply each pair, so I have 2 times 4 is going to be 8, 2 times 4 is going to be 8, 2 times 6 is going to be 12, and 3 times 6 is going to be 18. So my final value of result here, this result that I'm storing, this is going to be 8, 8, 12, 18, and that's going to end up replacing bar starting at 4. So the result I will end up with is going to be that the first part of bar is unchanged, and the last part is going to have this new value stored in there, so I'm going to have 8, 8, 12, 18. Some questions on any part of that work? So we've seen some sort of examples of these vector instructions where it's relatively straightforward how to use them. Well, let's look at some more realistic example. Let's look at our matrix multiply example from where we're doing cache blocking. We're not going to do cache blocking in this case, though in practice, to get the best performance, you combine this vector stuff with cache blocking. But we want to use vector instructions for this, so we're going to try and do this. So our first step is going to be that we're going to try to expand these loops in some way to expose groups of operations we can do sort of in that pairwise manner. And in this case, I'm dealing with ints, which are 32 bits, so I can fit 8 of them in a vector. So I want to have groups of 8 operations that are all sort of the same thing, so I can do them with one of these special instructions that does 8 pairs of adds or multiplies together. And the most straightforward way I have to do that is by just unrolling the innermost loop. There's other ways I could have done it too, but unrolling this innermost loop is probably the simplest. And here I have now an add and a multiply I want to do with vector instructions. So I have this multiply I want to do with vector instructions, where I'm going to multiply these values and these values, and I have this add I want to do with vector instructions. Now, the multiply is the operation we're going to do first, and when we think of that multiply, we have a bit of a problem. So, I want to get a vector that contains, for the right-hand side of the multiply here, b of k times n plus j plus 0 plus 1 plus 2. That we can do. If we just load from b starting at k times n plus j plus 0, I'm going to get those 8 elements, that's 256 bits of stuff from b. So that's fine. But if I look at the left-hand side of the multiply here, that's a problem. If I just load from A, I'm not going to get the same element of A 8 times. I'm going to get 8 different elements of A. So I need to somehow get a vector that contains the same thing from A copied 8 times in order to use the instruction we've seen. Now, we also have this addition, and for this we need to like load from C and store to C. That's not actually a problem, because if we think of how we load, we're gonna load from C starting at C, I times N plus J plus 0, and that's gonna give us 8 elements of C. That's exactly what we want to. But we do have this problem with A. So there's gonna be some intrinsic functions we're gonna need that we haven't seen before, and one of them is something that he'll call set one. And this is an intrinsic that will do what we wanted to do for A. It's gonna take one element of A, and rather than loading, you know, 256 bits of stuff from A, it's gonna load 32 bits of stuff from A and copy it 8 times. So there's an intrinsic for doing this, and it generates an assembly instruction that most notably includes this broadcast instruction, where basically the people designing these vector instructions realized, gosh, it's actually pretty common where people are gonna want to do the same thing to every element of the vector. So we have an instruction to help out with that, which is this broadcast instruction. And then there's an intrinsic that lets you use it. We also need to be able to multiply 32-bit values. That's gonna be done with this volo instruction. So now that we know about this set one intrinsic and the corresponding instruction that implements it, now we can implement our inner loop here that we've expanded, these 8 operations, we can do them with vector instructions. So here I have the code I want to vectorize. I'm gonna first deal with C. So I'm gonna say we're gonna want to read from C and write to C. So I'm gonna load from C starting at J, I times N plus J plus 0. And that's gonna give me all 8 elements. I'm gonna put that in a vector register that I'm gonna represent with the variable Cij. And when I'm done with Cij, I'm gonna store it back into C, because that's what this original code did after doing the addition. And I'm gonna store, you know, all 8 elements back into C. I have to load from B, so that I'm gonna do by using my normal load to load 8 elements, 256 bits of stuff from B. And I have to load from A and multiply that with C. So we mentioned we have this intrinsic for A, that's gonna give us 8 copies of this one element of A, so we're gonna use that. And then we're gonna do the multiply that's gonna multiply each pair. So we're gonna multiply the first copy of A with the first value from B, the second copy of the value from A with the second value from B, and so on. Again, all those pairs of values as this vector we call multiply results that is gonna be stored hopefully in a 256-bit register. Finally, we're gonna do the addition of those multiply results into the C values we loaded, which, remember, at the end is gonna be stored back into the array C. This gives us code that looks like this. So questions on how I did this process of vectorizing this code? And what that set one function was for? Yes? Question is, why is it necessary to load the values from C and then store them back rather than adding directly to C? So the way the intrinsics work, I have to pass to, the result of add goes into, isn't M256i. So if I could figure out how to assign that to C, I could do this, do what you ask, and sort of do it directly. The likely way the compiler would implement that is probably going to give us the same code that doing this explicit store does. And it does turn out compilers will do little optimizations, like adjusting the moves slightly, despite the intrinsics, like corresponding specific instructions. They'll often do that, not always. I think for the add instruction, I'm not sure if there's a version of the vector add instruction that takes some memory operand. So I think you would need to have a separate store instruction, but I'm not sure about that. But they were designed separately from the normal ad instruction, so they don't work quite the same way, just because designers made different decisions in the 2000s than the 80s. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at a different example of vectorization. So here I have some code here. I went to vectorize and I did some vectorization of it, which I left some of the code blank. And note something I did here is, as part of vectorizing it, I changed this I plus equals 1 to I plus equals 4. That was part of the transformation I did. We're dealing with longs here, so our vectors hold 4 longs, not 8 like in our previous example where we had ints. My question is, what goes in these two blanks to make this code actually equivalent for what result it computes? So you should think about, what transformation did I do to be able to vectorize this? So that was our first step in, like, using these vector instructions, was to define like four pairs of groups of operations that are of adds, multiplies, and so on that we could use. Something that might help to think about is that if we look at this load of AI, because we're loading 256 bits starting there, this is going to load A of I plus 1, A of I plus 2, A of I plus 3 into a vector. And the load into B of I is going to be similar. From the advisor. Back some more time? Okay, so let's start with who thinks A. B. Okay. C. D. Okay, so we have a split between A, B, and C with a plurality at B. So B looks kind of like the most natural. There's a problem there, is that if we think of how B works, we're going to get A of I. And like, if we think of starting out, initially it's going to be like 0, 1, 2, 3. And we're going to multiply that by our j's for b of j part. With, if we're doing b, we're going to load b of 0, 1, 2, 3, and then b of 4, 1, 2, 3. And it turns out a of 0 only gets multiplied by b of 0, b of 4, b of 8, b of 12, b of 16. So that's a problem with B. So B doesn't actually do the same calculation we only multiply A of 0 by B of 0, B of 4, B of 8, so on, A of 1 by B of 1, B of 5, and so on. So the best answer here is C. And to understand this, let's look at what transformation I actually did to generate this code. And we can also talk about why I did that transformation. There's a reason I didn't do the most straightforward thing. I didn't what I did was not just unrolling the innermost loop. Instead, I did this thing where I kind of did something kind of like cache blocking to expand the I loop, like split up the I loop, move it inside, and expand it. Something like cache blocking. And why did I do that? Well, if we think of what vector instructions are doing, they need to work well. We want to load a whole bunch of values from an array at once, which means we need to increase the spatial locality. So I did a transformation here that increased the spatial locality, because in order to use vector instructions, I need to have four things that are together, which I didn't have initially. So I did this transformation where, I expanded the I loop, so I kind of did cache blocking with I in order to get groups of four contiguous A and B values. And what I want to do to make that work is I want to multiply by the same B of J in each iteration of that loop, or to reach all the B of J's. And if you looked at what we did for the matrix multiply example, I just expanded the innermost loop. And you can absolutely do that in this case, but you end up with this code. And this code, well, we think of vectorizing it. Well, this first step here, this part is actually pretty good. We can do the multiply, that's easy. We have a set one to load a bunch of copies of B of I. We can use the normal load to load the parts of B of J. We can do the multiply to multiply all of those four pairs of values together. But then we want to do this plus equals operation. And we have a problem there. That yes, there's an add operation that adds four pairs of values together, but that's not what we're doing here. We're adding them all to the same place. So we could do that with vector instructions, but it would be something more complicated than just using our normal add instruction. We need to have temporary partial sums and add them together at the end or something like that, which you absolutely could do. That's not the most straightforward way of vectorizing it, because we have to do an extra work to handle the fact that we're ultimately summing up to the same result variable. And so by doing this other transformation, I kind of worked around that problem, and I had something that's easier to use vector instructions with. So questions? Example here. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some bookkeeping things with vector instructions. So one thing is that sometimes we have values that aren't in the place we wanted them in vector. So all the examples we've dealt with so far, we kind of had an easy time where we got things from arrays, they were exactly where we needed them once we got them in a vector, and that was great. But often real problems don't work out this way, and we'll need to move values around in a vector. So we'll have a vector of 1, 2, 3, 4, and we really want 3, 4, 1, 2. And we could do this by writing 1, 2, 3, 4 back to the array, moving things around in the array with normal instructions. But that's pretty slow, kind of gets rid of the point of using these vector instructions. So there are special instructions for moving values around within the vector registers. So taking the 256-bit register that has that array of four values and rearranging that register without writing it to memory. And this is called shuffling or swizzling or permuting. There's a whole bunch of different names. And hopefully you can use these instead of rearranging on the stack, sending it to memory and rearranging there, which is usually slow. So as an example, to do the 1, 2, 3, 4 to 3, 4, 1, 2, there are 64 values. This is a way of doing it with the Intel intrinsics. The way those work, it happens that you can encode the indices you want the value stored at as this funny integer. And there's an instruction which takes that integer and like processes that, you know, that list of indices to use. You know, there's special hardware for this. Because it's such a common operation, they added hardware to implement sort of this moving values around in the registered operation. I would note that I have to look up how to like write these instructions every single time I use them. I do not have this memorized. But I want you to know these exist, so if you're dealing with vector instructions and you are like, this is not in the place I want it, you can fix that. There are ways of doing it. You'll probably need to look up how they work. Some questions about shuffling? So also some historical notes and some notes about platforms that aren't x86. So x86, there's a whole bunch of versions of these vector instructions. And there's some early versions with 128-bit vectors called SSE and some number. The 128-bit vectors are stored in registers called XMM 0 through 15. And we're using these YMM registers which have 256-bit vectors, and this is a later version of this thing called AVX and AVX2, and they didn't do away with the SSE stuff, so it's still there. And the YMM registers are a superset of the XMM registers, just like RAX is a superset of EAX. There's also a 512-bit version of the extensions that we're not going to use in this class because our machines don't support that. And non-x86 platforms have their various own versions of these sort of vector instructions. So ARM has something called Neon, which is basically the same thing, but for ARM. MIPS has something called MSA. PowerPC has something called Ultivector VMX. And also, maybe more notably, GPUs, a lot of why GPUs are fast is that they basically implement this vector instruction idea all over the place. That is one of the big things they are doing. Not the only thing that makes sort of a GPU different than a normal processor, but it's one of the big things. And especially with GPUs, there are other ways to program sort of vector instructions. So there are alternate programming interfaces that aren't the same as writing assembly and aren't the same as writing intrinsics or writing normal C code. And if you've done stuff with GPUs, you've used some of these like CUDA or OpenCL. So these are other ways of writing sort of vector code that aren't like writing C, but also aren't like writing these intrinsics. Something in between. GPUs and, well, early processors that implemented vector instructions that for some reason Intel didn't copy, implemented a lot of features that are really useful in vector instruction sets that for some reason didn't make it into Intel's instruction set until very recently. Same with most other general purpose processors. Features like handling conditionals. So if you like want to add some values, but not always, like if you have like an if statement on the add, that's really hard to do. There are some features the processor can add where it can like let you specify, you know, I don't want to add all these fields, just the ones I specified. That's a common feature in vector instructions, and Intel added it shockingly recently, even though it's a pretty obvious useful thing. Other things that you can have are supporting variable length vectors better. So with sort of the Intel's vector instructions, if you don't want 256 bits, if you like want 7 values instead of 8, well, too bad, you got 7. So there's often hardware support on sort of more specialized vector processor machines where they'll have some better way for the hardware to handle the case where you don't want to use the whole vector. You notice that when we load values, we kind of have to load contiguous values with the vector instructions we've seen. Hardware that sort of specializes in vector instruction often implements a way of loading a bunch of non-contiguous values. So like if you want to load from a of 0, a of n, a of 2 times n, a of 4, 3 times n, they'll have a way of doing that sort of that's supported by the hardware. This is actually pretty complicated for the hardware to implement, but if you're making something like a GPU, it's really worth implementing sort of a lot of extra hardware complexity to make that fast. So they'll have instructions to load and store non-contiguous sets of values to handle cases like that. And that obviously makes vectorizing things a lot easier, maybe not easier to be fast, but easier at least to work than what we have to deal with, where if we want to load a of 0 and a of n into a vector, we kind of have to like first copy of an a of n somewhere. That's what I'm going to say about vector instructions. Questions, comments? Okay, so I have one last sort of optimization topic, which is basically on the sort of what to do in the real world side. And there's two big things I want you to remember if you are given a programming cell to make it fast. The first thing you should do is make sure your compiler's doing its job. Make sure you figure out what options your compiler has for optimization. Make sure you're actually using them. The other thing is spend the effort where it matters. If you have a program that does a big calculation and it's slow, don't just say, okay, this program's slow, it does a big calculation, I'm gonna make the calculation faster. Measure things first. You might find out, for example, that program is spending half its time parsing floats in files that are written in text. And if that's the case, probably your easiest and most effective fix is to make that better. And very commonly, programmers will not guess correctly why programs are slow. So you should check first. You should figure out where is the time being spent, because in practice, programmers are very often wrong. And there's a set of tools you should use called profilers, which should be your first step for figuring it out. So for our performance assignments, we kind of tell you, this is the function to make fast. But in a real program, that you're not going to be told that. So you need to figure out what functions need to be made fast. So a profiler is a tool where you can run your program and will time where that program is spending its time. So on Linux, for example, there's a the profiler I'd recommend, assuming you have system administrator type access, is called perf. And here's some example of the output of perf running on HCLRS. So you can see here I have a children column and a self column. So let's look, for example, here. So here, I have the name of a function. So this function is a function that's part of a hash table implementation. And if I look at the column, it says that the self time for this function is about 23%. So that means that when my profiler was observing the program, 23% of the time, I was in that part of the hash table implementation. You also have this children time, which is 41%. So what that means is that 41% of the time, I was in that function or in something that function was calling. So since I was only in that function 23% of the time, I can say that like about 18% of the time I was in stuff it was calling. And so this is useful for figuring out where am I actually spending my time. So one thing you'll see is that this is HCLRS, and it turns out, well, HCLRS is spending tons of time doing hash table lookups. So if I want to make it faster, maybe I should think about why am I using a hash table all the time, and could I avoid that? Rather than like optimizing other things. Questions on profilers in this profiling example? Okay, so in our last 10 minutes, we'll go to our next topic, which our last set of topics for the semester are going to be about hardware support for writing operating systems. So to talk about that, we need to talk about, first, we're going to talk a bit about stuff the operating system needs to do and does do. So here I have a program with an infinite loop. So let's say I SSH into portal, I'm assuming you can also SSH into. I run this program, and let's say, to keep things simpler, that portal machine only has one core. So I start this program on portal, compile it, run it, and you try to SSH into portal. Can you still use portal? Who thinks, yes, you'll still be able to SSH into that machine, do stuff. Okay, few people who thinks, no, you won't. Okay, who, no clue. Okay, so majority, no clue. We have some people, yes, some people, no. So the reason you might think no is that, you know, if I look at this program, I think of the assembly it's going to generate. There's nothing in that assembly that lets anything else run. The assembly is just going to be like main, jump main. Right, just going to, and there's nothing there to let your SSH shell, you know, the shell you SSH into run. So it seems like you won't be able to do anything. On the other hand, you might know that it would be pretty bad if the portal actually worked this way, that if you made a buggy program that made an infinite loop, no one else could use SSH into the machine or do anything. So that's kind of a disconnect, right? Because the code here doesn't seem to support that. So what's really going on? Maybe to get more insight, rather than having a loop that does nothing, we can have a loop that times something. And we're going to time nothing. So we're just going to time, get the time. And what we'd expect if we were running just alone, we'd expect, oh, we're going to get a time, then we're going to get a time, and that's going to take a fixed amount of time between those two, you know, clock reads, right? We're going to read the clock, then we're going to read the clock again, we should expect like a fixed interval every time. If I actually run this, so here's a graph of the numbers I got. And this graph has a log scale. So typically, I measured something around 20 nanoseconds between my two reads of the clock, but sometimes I measured milliseconds. These times where I measured milliseconds of time. And, you know, we might say, well, things might take a long time, we'll like have cache misses, but when we're keeping running this loop, that shouldn't be happening. So what's going on? And what's happening is something called time multiplexing. That I don't actually get to have my loop program run on the processor all the time. Instead, it only gets to run on the processor some of the time. And when I'm not running on the processor, it looks like to me that some instruction I ran just took a long time. So like basically this simple move instruction appeared to take a million cycles. But during those million cycles, something was actually happening. And what was happening was other programs got to run. So we were sharing this core. And we're going to talk about how does this happen. And it turns out that to make this happen, we need to have an additional program involved, and that program is called the operating system. So the operating system is going to be this special program responsible for managing all the programs, and it's going to run, and it's going to be responsible for doing the work of switching from loop to SSH, or switching from SSH to Firefox. So now, we have a problem here, that the code for loop doesn't have any way of running the operating system. So something else needs to run the operating system, and there's going to be hardware support for this. There's going to be a hardware feature called exceptions that we'll talk about next time, which will make the hardware run the operating system, even though the code we're running doesn't say anything about running the operating system. There's going to be this hardware support for causing the operating system to run in the middle of some other program interrupting what it's doing. So the operating system will run, and we'll run some code we'll call an exception handler, and that code, in this case, will decide to switch to a different program. So one question might be, so how does the OS switch to a different program? So we learned that it's going to start running from the special hardware mechanism called exceptions, but once it starts running, it's going to have to somehow start running that new program, but we also need to save the program that's currently running so we can switch back to it later. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to save all the stuff the original program was using, in this case loop, and we're going to restore the stuff that SSH had saved earlier. So the stuff we save, we're going to call the context. So we're going to call this operation a context switch. So our context is going to be all the register values, the condition codes, the program counter, and possibly some other stuff we'll talk about later. Basically everything the program is using right now in the processor, the OS is going to save that somewhere, and it's going to restore saved values from the thing it's switching to. So sort of what the OS is doing is that the OS is going to sort of copy the current registers and program counter to some saved location, and it's going to restore the new ones and jump back to where, in this case, SSH was. Another way we can think about this is that the OS's memory is going to store the registers and so on for every program that's not currently active on the processor. And when we want to switch from program A, that's currently on the processor, to program B, the OS is going to arrange to sort of swap those registers with its saved ones. And then the processor now has the registers for this program B, it's going to be running program B, and we have program A's values sitting around if we need them later. So questions about this context switch idea? So we're going to run the operating system with this special hardware mechanism. We'll talk about what exactly triggers it next time. And the operating system is going to save what loop was doing and restore what SSH was doing to keep running it. Okay. So there's one thing we kind of glossed over when talking about this context switch, and that has to do with memory. So let's say I'm running program A, and program A here has a global variable stored in address 10,000, and what we're trying to do here is load that global variable into REX. And if only program A is running, what we'd expect is we'd always load 42 with this code, assuming that code, there's no other code which manipulates the global variable here. But let's say we have a program B that tries to write 99 to the same memory location. So the question is, what do you expect to happen? It'll be a little quick because of the time. So who expects us to get the result REX, I should say, be explicit, REX in program A? And I only care about program A. So who expects program A? Our result's going to be 42. It's going to be the same as if program B wasn't running. Okay, which people think the result's going to be 99. Program B is going to change the value of the variable. Few people who thinks we're going to get a result that's going to vary, or we might have a crash. Okay, so we have a big split. And it's going to turn out that our results are going to be that for program A, REX always ends up being 42. And for program B, it may or may not crash. So why do we want it always to be 42? Well, if you're running a program with like a global variable, it'd be really nice if that global variable didn't like change because some other program had a bug. So we're going to implement features that prevent that. And the feature we're going to implement is that we're going to give each program its own memory land. So each program can have code and data at the same addresses, but it's going to be different code and different data. And this seems like a problem with our context switch idea, because now it sounds like, oh, in order to switch programs, I need to save program A's memory and restore program B's. And that would be really slow. So that's not what we're going to do. So instead, there's going to be another thing the hardware is going to support to make this easier. And what we're going to do is we're going to have something called an address space, where the hardware, rather than when a program A tries to access OX 10,000, or program B tries to access OX10000, rather than actually accessing that memory location, there's going to be a mapping the OS sets up that the processor is going to use, and it's going to determine where these accesses go. So our program B access for this could end up in its data, and program A's access for it could end up in program A's data, so they'll access different things. Or alternately, the OS might say, you know, for our same example, OX10000 might go to program A's data, but the mapping for program B could specify that that address should instead trigger an error. And you might know that error as a segment. So over for the rest of the semester, we're going to first talk about exceptions, and then we're going to talk about this mapping mechanism as our final topic for the semester. I think I'm out of time here. Questions down here, but